Anyway, the most common words that I ever hear said by an environmentalist anywhere in the country are, "We're fucked. We're so fucked." Not in the good sense. I ask people all over the country, "Do you believe that our culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living?" Yeah. That's the response I get everywhere. And, well, no, one guy stuck his hand up in the air, and everybody looked at him, and he said, "Oh, voluntary, no, of course not." So the next question is, if you don't believe that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for our strategy and for our tactics? And the answer is we don't know, because we don't talk about it. Because we're so busy trying to pretend that we have hope that we can't allow ourselves to recognize. And I have to tell you, I actually don't think that things are as bad as they seem. I think they're about 300,000 times worse. A couple years ago, a friend of mine from Northern California was working on pesticide issues. She called me up one night, said, "I can't take it anymore. It's getting to me. It's just killing me." And, I mean, just the horrors of the pesticide use. I said, "Yeah, I understand." And she said, "Unless it's stopped, the dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet, won't it?" I said, "Yeah, everything it can." She said, "It has a death urge, doesn't it? It wants to kill everything." I said, "Yeah, it does." She said, "It hates everything, doesn't it?" I said, "Yeah, even itself." I said, "We're not going to make it to some great new glorious tomorrow, are we?" And I thought for a second, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing to say, which is, "I've been waiting for you to say that." And the reason I did that is because about 11 or 12 years ago, I was undergoing this collapse where I would just burst into tears a lot, a couple times a day, three or four times a week. And I was crying over the salmon and grizzly bears, prairie dogs. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, "So Derek, just back off. You know, the problems will still be there when you come back." And I knew I couldn't do that. And I mean, besides which, if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? You know, if you're not going to cry about the death of grizzly bears, what are you going to cry about? There's got to be, I mean, if crying means anything at all, you know. And one day I called my friend, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian. She's a writer and activist. And I said, "This is killing me. I can't take it." She said, "I understand." And I said, "You know, unless it's stopped, the dominant culture is going to kill everything, isn't it?" She said, "Yeah, everything it can." And I said, "It has a death urge, doesn't it?" She said, "Yeah, it does. It wants to kill everything." And I said, "It hates everything, doesn't it?" She said, "Yeah, it does, even itself." And I said, "We're not going to make it to some great new glorious tomorrow, are we?" And she said the best thing she could have said, which is, "I've been waiting for you to say that." And the reason that that was the best thing she could have said is because it normalized my despair. And it let me know that a despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that sorrow is just sorrow, and pain is just pain. And it let me know that I realized then that it wasn't so much the sorrow nor even pain that hurt as it was my resistance to it. And it killed me. And no, it was sort of didn't. It let me know that I could face this, face how awful things are, and it didn't kill me. But it did kill me, which is actually kind of cool, because one of the most amazingly intelligent things that the Nazis did to the Jews was they co-opted rationality, so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather move to a ghetto? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather get on a cattle car? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather take a shower? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you this, that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a much higher rate of survival than those who didn't. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. But so the amazing thing was, the cool thing was, that night, I died. And there's a wonderful thing of that day. And one of the wonderful things that happens when you're dead is they can't touch you anymore. You know, I can still sing, and I can still make love, and I can still fight like hell, but they can't touch me because I'm dead already. And one of the reasons that my mother stayed in the relationship with my father, well, one of the reasons was because there were no battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s, but another reason was because of the false hope that my father would change. And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations. Is there anybody who really thinks that warehouses are going to stop deforesting because we ask nicely? You know, is there anybody who thinks that if we all hold hands and sing Give Peace a Chance, that those in power will stop killing brown people all over the world? It's like, what do we do? So here's the deal. One of the questions I get, you know, is people say, so Derek, if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? And I say, because life is really good. You know, it's like, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart, we're fucked. Life is so good. And we're fucked. Our life is so good. There's this idea that if you recognize how bad things are, that you have to be miserable. But the truth is, I'm really sad, and I'm really happy, and I'm really full of hate, and I'm really full of joy, and I'm really full of love, and I'm full of all these things. Oh my God, I'm allowed to feel more than one thing at a time? What's that? Or it's like the other day, I was lying by this pond right near my home, and I was looking up at the sky, and there were the sun was coming through the redwood needles, and I was thinking, oh man, you know, what more could anybody want? You know, I mean, social life would be nice, but okay. So that's that. And then the other question I get sometimes is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? And my answer to that is, well, I don't really like parties. And oh, this great Irish proverb: is this a private fight or can anybody enter? And so I don't. That question about if things are so bad, why don't you just party, why don't you just quit, that bothered me for a long time until I finally got an answer to it, which is I realized that that question reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. Because if you're in love, you act to defend your beloved. And of course results matter to you, but they don't matter to whether you make the effort. You know, six guys with machine guns burst in on a woman and her three children. And does she say, let's have a margarita, boys? You know, it's like she does whatever is appropriate to the circumstance. And this guy wrote me from Spokane not very long ago and said that he had a 15-year-old son who is really active and working for social justice and all those groovy things. And his son is great, and he's really concerned that his son might not be active later because he didn't know how to give his son hope. He didn't want to lie to his son, but he didn't know how to give hope. And I said, don't try to give your son hope. Give him love, and he'll be active. You know, I've been bashing hope. You know, I'm not a big fan of Buddhism, but there's this line I love, which is that hope and fear chase each other's tails. And there's another part that I think is really cool about the whole hope thing, which is, you know, I've been bashing hope for a couple years now. And in Colorado not very long ago, 2 weeks ago, somebody from the audience said, so can you define hope, please? It's like, oh, shit, I never did that. And so I don't know. What do I mean by hope? I mean, it's like all the environmentalists I know, you know, we're just hanging on by our fingernails, hoping and praying that grizzly bears and salmon and prairie dogs and whatever our favorite creatures are hang on for another 20 years until civilization comes down. You know, we're just that's what we're hoping for. Hope, hope, hope. What's hope? And then somebody asked me, so then I turned to the audience and said, I don't know. So can somebody tell me what hope is? And it was so cool because different people gave different parts of it. We came up with a definition I think is really good, which is hope is a longing for a future condition. At first we had hope as a longing for a desired future condition, but you know, you don't hope for a really crappy future condition. So hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Because you don't have hope. I don't hope that I have dinner tonight, you know? I can just go have dinner. On the other hand, you know, I hope that the next time I get on an airplane, it doesn't fall down. And I've realized, it's like, I don't hope that coho salmon survive. I will not allow the dominant culture to drive coho salmon extinct. I will do what it takes.